ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
A body on the train tracks in mysterious circumstances.
Mark's been found on railway tracks.
An award-winning ABC podcast and a fresh inquest underway.
Every time we walk out of that inquest, just being like, oh my God.
You weren't out there on the train tracks that night?
Absolutely not.
As the answers get closer, the podcast is back.
He said he's guilty. He's guilty as sin.
Search for Unravel Blood on the Tracks. It's on the ABC Listen app or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome to Late Night Live. I'm David Marr, coming to you from Gadigal land in Sydney. Reports from Sudan over the last months have been gut-wrenching, but haven't had the coverage television news is giving to the horrors of Gaza and Ukraine. Later in the show, we'll be talking to the New York Times Africa Bureau Chief Declan Walsh about what's driving the civil war in Sudan and the possibilities for peace. And as we commemorate 50 years since the GG sacked the PM, we ask, where the hell is the footage? There were television crews everywhere on the day, but half a century down the track, there's not much to show. But first, to Australian politics right now. Anna Henderson is Chief Political Correspondent for SBS World News. Anna, welcome to the show.
Thank you, David. Lovely to be here.
Now, I've no doubt you heard Julian Lisa, the member for Barara, Liberal member for Barara, on the show last week, giving John Kerr a tick for everything he did on November the 11th, everything. So I presume the Liberal Party is holding some sort of celebrations for the November the 11th, perhaps a banquet. How's the Liberal Party kicking up its heels?
Well, you know, I listen religiously to every interview on your show, wherever possible, David. I'll have to take your word for it on that one because I didn't hear what Julian had to say, but I haven't heard many on the opposition benches weighing in any sort of controversial or critical way to the, I guess, the work that's been done to note the dismissal in 1975. I can, though, bring you news of the Prime Minister tonight delivering a speech and addressing this directly as, and these are very strong words, quote, a calculated plot hatched by conservative forces which sacrificed conventions and institutions in the pursuit of power. So the Prime Minister was willing to certainly have quite a strong say this speech at Old Parliament House tonight, marking the 50th anniversary.
And I'm not going to crit you for missing the Julian Lisa interview because I know you were extremely busy at the time. But I can't tell you. I mean, total support for what Kerr did. Surely, I mean, tomorrow the Whitlam forces are gathering in Old Parliament House to bemoan what happened on November the 11th, 50 years ago. Surely the Liberals are holding some sort of function to assert their pleasure, their joy, their continuing support for what Kerr did. Can't you find something?
Well, I think the Liberals are a little busy at the moment trying to work out how to kind of plot a future for their own party.
Yes.
And they don't possibly have as much time as you would imagine to reflect on the dismissal. But I guess I read something from Michelle Grattan today that I thought was very timely, where she said, you know, that while the Labor Party was reflecting on the dismissal and what happened with the blowing up of the Labor Party at that time, the coalition was now trying to focus on not kind of completely blowing up its future. So there's some kind of continuum there.
Before we carefully examine the position of the coalition at the moment, there is news, I understand, of some sort of commemoration for Gough in Canberra.
Well, tonight the Prime Minister announced there will be a Whitlam statue in Canberra. And for anyone who's visited Canberra and walked around the city, as many do, we will all remember that there are statues popping up around the place, former prime ministers and other important members of parliament. They sort of tower over you and they're quite an incredible feature of the Canberra walking skyline. And we will have a commissioning of a statue of Whitlam to add to the mix. To go and stand next to and size up to, David.
A great hooded figure in bronze. I can't wait. It's going to be extraordinary. But now,
very
look,
tall.
Yeah, very tall. Very tall. An immense nose. Now, look, Anna, what is the state of the coalition at the moment? Just give us an update. Where are they? Still tearing themselves apart?
They're dealing with the most existential crisis that I've lived through in Canberra in terms of trying to work out what they stand for and chart a path forward. And that's the Liberal Party, because the Nationals are pretty clear on what they want to do and stand for. And at this stage appear relatively united around the position that they have decided to take. And then the Liberals now are trying to deal with the fallout from that. And the reality that now that the Nationals have dropped net zero from their party platform, for what they stand for, that the Liberals now have to really potentially toe the line and drop that language as well, which will be very challenging for many moderates in particular.
I know that the coalition vote has fallen to a tragic sort of 24%, but 20% of that is Liberal and 4% roughly of that, it's pretty hard to calculate exactly, but about 4% of that is National. So the 4% is going to make the 20% kowtow.
Well, the Nationals would see it very differently in terms of the way that the nation is spread, the people they represent, the number of seats they have in the lower house and the Senate. They don't see it in that kind of primary percentage across the country, because when you look at how many seats they have in the lower house, they're a powerful force. And they also believe, and you know, I've spoken to many Nationals over the past couple of weeks to try and understand what's brought them to this position, why they've taken this decision now, and to push them on questions like, you know, the fact that their National Federal Conference, where this decision was made, was sponsored partially by the Minerals Council, for example. It does open them to questions around, you know, which lobbying forces are potentially having an impact on the decisions that they make. And what I'm told, David, and you know, we will have many years to pore over electoral donation disclosures and other materials into the future. What I'm adamantly told is that there is a strong view within the Nationals that there are a lot of country people who they represent who are very unhappy about the big industrial renewables plans, the transmission lines going through the land in those areas, and the unfairness, they say, in the view of many farmers, about who wins and who loses from the renewables race.
Sure, sure. Then again, we know that there are many, many, many farmers deeply worried about the climate and quite used to having power lines crossing their gorgeous acres, because power lines have been crossing gorgeous acres for about 60 or 70 years now, haven't they? But look, let's put that to one side.
I think that's absolutely true as well. I completely agree. There is a diversity of views in the country. But when you put to members of the National Party why they've taken this approach, that is the answer they give.
They come out with
that the politics is going to work. Yeah.
Okay, here's the question. Why not just sabotage efforts to get rid of coal and gas? Why not just go about sabotaging the stuff? Why is it necessary for the National Party to make this extraordinary declaration of getting rid of net zero? Why does it have to be declared in this way? Why can't they just go about making a mess of things?
Well, again, I'm conscious of the knowledge that there are various layers of this story. Not all of them might be apparent to us at this point in time. But there is an ideological strength in the view within members of the National Party room that net zero is going to become toxic as a concept. And that they don't want to be in a position to be tied to it when they think it could be a way to electorally differentiate themselves from the Labor Party and potentially make inroads. Now, does this sound, when I put it to pollsters who are looking at city seats, like absolute political poison and something that is going to end disastrously for the Liberal Party? All of them say yes, across the board. But still, that ideological fervour exists within the National Party and within some parts, strong parts of the Liberal Party, that net zero and the Labor renewables transition will mean higher power prices, that people will eventually punish the Labor Party, and they're going to be on the right side of history.
So meanwhile, they'll just walk the party and the coalition over a cliff.
And as one other member of parliament who's, you know, involved in the coalition side of politics said to me, stop looking for logic in what's happening. Stop trying to find a narrative. This is just a whole lot of people who enjoy being in opposition and don't really know how to govern, making decisions to try and blow up the government's policy. They're not thinking strategically as a grouping. I still don't know where the truth lies here, but it is very hard to understand how, you know, when you speak to moderate liberals who are trying to campaign in city areas, how they're going to sell what the Liberal Party is about to potentially agree to, dropping net zero terminology altogether, how they're going to sell that at the next election to younger voters in particular.
What's your hunch on whether the Liberals will follow the Nats, dropping net zero?
I think it's incredibly likely that they will. And that's because, you know, the vast majority of people I'm now speaking to, including within the moderates, have already kind of resigned themselves to thinking that net zero is likely to be gone, and that there'll be a broad commitment to Paris, and that the view is that still signals net zero after 2050, but they drop the language which they think is politically expedient to do and is now sort of something that's tied specifically to the Liberal Party, to the Labor Party.
Any news of whether the Minerals Council will be sponsoring the Christmas party for the Nats?
The Minerals Council does donate to both political parties. I must make that clear.
Of course.
I just thought it was interesting they were the key sponsor of the Nationals Federal Council because of this, you know, narrative that can form and that Nationals do push back against about the influence of the mining lobby in terms of their decision making. And, you know, Hancock Prospecting is still one of the biggest donors to the coalition as well. So you do see that mining interests do have quite an obvious role in terms of being benefactors of these political movements. And also there's a lot about the political donations process, which hasn't been made clear about what happened just ahead of the last election as well. We're still waiting till, I think, February next year to find out that donations data.
Remarkable. Remarkable. Most countries give it to you in real time, end of each week, but we have to wait to the following February. Anna, thank you. We have to wait another week before we speak to you again. Thank you so much for joining us on Late Night Live to make sense of Canberra and to try to straighten me out.
I hope that I can give you more clarity next week.
Good woman. Coming up, Sudan, the terrible, terrible war going on in Sudan. Two weeks ago, rebels in Sudan took the city of Al-Fasher from the Sudanese army in an assault so violent that bloodstains could be seen from space. This vicious civil war, fought for 2.5 years between the Sudanese army and rebels known as the RSF, has left at least 150,000 dead, 11 million displaced, and right now 21 million Sudanese in acute hunger. It's by any standards an appalling mess. But what's it about? In a word, gold. As Sudan burns and its people starve, writes Declan Walsh, the Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, a gold rush is underway. Declan has been covering the war from the start, and he joins us now from Nairobi. Declan, welcome to Late Night Live.
Thank you, David. It's good to be here.
Declan, what happened at Al-Fasher?
Well, it was basically the bloody culmination of an 18-month siege. This paramilitary group, the Rapid Support Forces, that's been fighting Sudan's army for control of the country for 2.5 years now. As part of that, it had been laying siege to the city of Al-Fasher, which was the last remaining obstacle to complete control over Darfur. That's this enormous region in western Sudan. And to press that siege, they had resorted to medieval tactics, really. They ringed the city with a 40-mile-long wall or an earthen berm that prevented food or medicine from getting in or out in the final stages of it. There were drone strikes, artillery, a really punishing siege. And that came to a head a couple of weeks ago when the RSF finally pushed out the last Sudanese soldiers from the city. And what followed was really these, shocking scenes that we've seen coming out on videos, but also through eyewitness testimony of massacres taking place in the city. We've had people who fled the city saying that they were shot at, some of them killed as they tried to leave. They left along these roads that were littered with bodies. The World Health Organization said that over 450 people were killed in a massacre at the city's last remaining hospital. So it's really been, I think we've really just seen these. In some respects, this has been a massacre foretold. Many people who've been watching Sudan closely had been watching with concern the siege of Fashir. But unfortunately, the scenes that have come out of there have, matched those expectations and even gone beyond them.
So Sudan is now effectively split east-west, is that right?
That's right. Largely speaking, the rapid support forces control the western part of the country, and the Sudanese military holds what remains of the capital, Khartoum, which they recaptured last March, and the east of the city along the Red Sea, or the east of the country along the Red Sea.
And there are gold mines in both halves.
Sudan has some of the largest gold deposits in Africa. It's an industry that really took off about 15 years ago when the country's access to oil diminished because the country split in two after South Sudan seceded. Most of the oil fields were in South Sudan or along that border. And so the gold industry has been flourishing for years, but really nothing like we've seen during this war. There are gold deposits across Sudan, this enormous country, the third largest in Africa, and both sides in the war have been exploiting that gold as a way to finance the fight, to sustain their fighters. And in some ways, gold has also shaped the conflict itself as well.
The leader of the RSF took control of one of the biggest mines, you write, back in 2017. So that sort of predates the outbreak of the civil war itself.
Yeah, that's this commander. His name is Mohamed Hamdan, also widely known as Hemeti in Sudan. And he's this paramilitary leader who rose up through the ranks over the last couple of decades in Darfur. He was a commander of the notorious group, the Janjaweed, 20 years ago in Darfur, when there was also a very bloody conflict there. And over in the 2010s, he really rose through the ranks. The Janjaweed transformed into this group that is now known as the Rapid Support Forces. And he grew his personal riches and his political and military strength through gold. That started when his forces seized this the country's largest mine in Darfur at a place called Jebel Mara in 2017, and Hemeti used that wealth to expand the strength and the size of his forces. But he also started to build this business empire that extended across everything from real estate to livestock processing, so many different areas. And a lot of it really was rooted in this gold. And then as he grew in strength, he expanded his gold empire inside the country to mines that were really, all across the west of Sudan. At one point, he was working in association with these Russian mercenaries called Wagner. Before the war started, I visited a mine that was operated by Wagner operatives in the north of Sudan. So really, gold has played this central role in the rise of this group and of the political fortunes of its leader, General Hamdan or Hemeti.
How did this tip over into war?
Well, it started really as a power struggle between Hemeti and the leader of the military, General Burhan. Both of these men had seized power together, actually, in a coup in 2021. Just to rewind slightly, you know, Sudan's longtime autocrat Omar Bashir was ousted in these popular protests in 2019. That was really, I was there for that. That was this euphoric moment of hope for many Sudanese because, you know, after decades of autocracy and repression, this man was gone, and Sudanese hoped that they would transition to a democracy. Unfortunately, that dream only really lasted a couple of years because then Hemeti and Burhan, the two most powerful military figures in the country, seized power together. But that alliance slowly unraveled. Tensions between these two men became a sort of reflection of broader tensions inside the Sudanese security forces between these two competing wings. And that eventually spilled over into open fighting on the streets of Khartoum, the capital, in April 2023. But that was really just, that was the starting point for this war. After that, since then, it has metastasized into this much larger war that has encompassed so many other different forces. There's a whole lot of armed groups that have been sort of dormant or semi-dormant across Sudan, sort of holdovers from previous conflicts. Then they got sucked into the conflict. And then most significantly, the war began to draw in foreign powers that started to take sides on one side or the other, funding and arming either side in the war, trying to back a winner, really, but ultimately making it much, much worse and much, much harder to reach reach a ceasefire, let alone any sort of settlement of the conflict itself.
On ABC Radio National, this is Late Night Live. I'm David Marr. I am talking to Declan Walsh, who is the Africa Bureau Chief for the New York Times, stationed in Nairobi. And we're talking about the civil war in Sudan. Declan, all this time, gold is being frantically mined across Sudan. Where does that gold go and who owns it?
So, as in most African countries, the vast majority of Sudan's gold output goes to Dubai in the United Arab Emirates. Dubai is the hub for 90% of all the gold that comes out of Africa. And it's particularly a hub for smuggled gold as well as officially produced gold.
And this gold is not officially produced, I take it, from Sudan.
It's a mix of the two. The country's official gold figures, just the official gold figures for last year, show that about $1.5 billion worth was exported, I think 65 tons. Nearly all of that went to the UAE. At the minimum, at least the same amount was smuggled out. So it's really this multi-billion dollar industry that has grown. The export figures for gold for last year were about 50% more than they were in 2022, the last year just before the war started. So that's really to give you a sense that already this was an important industry in Sudan. But since the war, it has really expanded on both sides of the line, it must be said, not just for the RSF, but also for the Sudanese military, which has its own sort of network of mines that it either owns or controls, has purchased over in the east of the country.
And is the prospect of getting hold of the gold the reason why countries are backing not only one side or the other, but I take it some countries are backing both sides?
Yes, I mean, there's so much money involved in this war, and it has, you know, this very sophisticated war economy has grown up, and it has led to these kind of distortions where, for instance, the United Arab Emirates is the main backer of the RSF, even though it denies it. You know, there's been a lot of reporting, there's been testimony from UN inspectors, from American congresspeople. Many people have documented how the UAE is backing the RSF on one side of the fight, And yet on the other side of the fight in the with Sudan's military, the UAE also is the main shareholder in one of the largest industrial gold mines in the country. Similarly, Russia has threw its weight behind the RSF at the start of the war, but now, and indeed had been involved in gold mining, but now is allying itself with Sudan's military on the other side of the war and has been proposing gold deals in exchange for weapons on that side too. I wouldn't say gold is necessarily the driving factor, the single largest driving factor in the war, but it's certainly a very important one. You know, Sudan is this country that has enormous agricultural wealth and great mineral resources, but actually has largely been sort of cash poor, if you like. So gold is really the main source of income for fighters, for these fighting groups on both sides of the war. And it's also provided what they call perverse incentives for all these other actors to profit from the war. And that can be everyone from these, you know, foreign powers that are arming both sides in the war to this extensive array of, you know, kind of warlords and corrupt officials and many other people in the region who take a cut effectively from smuggling Sudanese gold across Sudan's very porous borders and eventually helping, you know, trading it until it eventually reaches the UAE. As part of our reporting last year, we tracked a single shipment of gold that was worth about $25 million as it made its way from these artisanal gold mines in Darfur, really in one of the most remote parts of the country. And it was smuggled across the border into South Sudan. It went on one flight, then on another flight. Then we had documents that showed how a corporate jet, which in fact had been chartered from the US, landed in South Sudan, you know, with assistance from various officials from several different countries. You know, did a 90-minute turnaround on a runway. All these suitcases filled with gold were loaded onto that plane, and then it took off for the United Arab Emirates, where presumably it vanished into the international gold markets.
Declan is reducing there to a few words a magnificent report that he wrote for the New York Times in December of last year, The Gold Rush at the Heart of a Civil War. It's an extraordinary piece. Declan, there is some prospect at this point, I understand, of a ceasefire, but such prospects have come and gone in the past. What chance do you give it?
I mean, if you were a betting person, you wouldn't put a lot of money on a ceasefire in Sudan right now. But having said that, it is probably the most serious effort at a ceasefire that we've seen since the start of the war. You know, the US had certainly played some role in diplomacy, and they had an envoy under the Biden administration. Trump administration initially didn't seem to show any interest in Sudan at all. But over the last 3 or 4 months, we've seen President Trump's envoy to Africa, Massad Boulos, bring together this group of Arab diplomats from the United Arab Emirates, from Egypt, and from Saudi Arabia. And they've come up with a sort of ceasefire plan in September that initially just looked like a paper proposal. But in recent weeks, there's been a number of meetings seem to push that idea forward. The RSF say that they're willing to go ahead with this ceasefire. The other side, they'll say that they're not. And I think the reality is that these terrible scenes that we're seeing out of El Fasher and the kind of outrage that they are generating, not just across the region here, but really, I think, across the world because of the videos that are coming out showing these terrible atrocities, I think that's putting pressure on the RSF to at least appear to make a concession. But as I said at the outset, you know, whether that's going to lead to a ceasefire, I mean, there's a long and sorry history of failed efforts over the last 2 years. So you'd be right to be skeptical. But I think people are so desperate at this point that they will cling to whatever hope they can get.
The United States has sanctioned various players in all of this mess, hasn't it? Has that yielded any kind of results?
Very hard to say. I mean, the US has sanctioned at this point all of the principals in the war. You know, the leaders of both factions of the military and the RSF are both under American sanctions at the moment. In fact, the US also made an official designation of genocide against the RSF and Hemeti last January. They've also imposed sanctions on trading companies in the UAE that are used by the RSF, not just to trade gold, but also to run this broader commercial empire and to acquire weapons, vehicles, things like that through the UAE. But on the ground, we've really not seen much evidence that these sanctions have had a significant impact. And in fact, a couple of weeks ago, we saw senior RSF leaders who are under American sanctions turn up in Washington, staying in some of the fanciest hotels in the city as part of these efforts to breach a peace deal. Now, of course, you know, diplomats would argue that, you know, you have to bring in the people who are responsible for the violence in order to make peace. But it's certainly a jarring sight to see that, you know, the US earlier had imposed these sanctions on individuals, ostensibly as a way of isolating them. And yet they seem to be able to, you know, stay at the Waldorf Hotel in Washington and move freely through the world, even as the fighting continues, even as we see some of the scenes that we've seen coming out of Fasher.
Even if there were some sort of peace deal here, would it involve the Hemeti family giving up their immense gold holdings? Or is that now forever? Do we have this immensely rich family with all of these mines at their disposal?
It seems that it would be inevitable that, you know, control over gold would be part of any settlement in the country, even though what that might look like at this stage is really hard to say. You know, at one point there were suggestions from diplomats that if a peace deal could be struck, that perhaps, you know, the Hemeti and his family would perhaps move abroad to somewhere like the UAE and run their business from there. But, you know, Hemeti and his family have made it clear that they wish to stay in Sudan, that they are from Darfur, that they want to build their political base around there, and they actually, of course, aspire to control of the entire country. So there's little sign that they would be willing to do that. But as probably the single largest, certainly the greatest source of exports that Sudan has, and one of the single largest drivers of the economy, there's no doubt that, you know, gold will be a crucial part of any future negotiations over where Sudan goes in any kind of peace dispensation.
The UN Human Rights Council is holding, I understand, an emergency meeting on Sudan this Friday. What's that about? What can be expected from that?
Well, again, this is just another measure of the outrage that, you know, that the scenes out of Fasher are generating. In the past, we've seen some of these sessions before. At other points in the war, there was an earlier massacre of between 10 and 15,000 people in another part of Darfur at the end of 2023. But we've often seen, you know, the Human Rights Council become divided on partisan lines. We've seen Sudan's military, which controls the official government, trying to block certain resolutions that might be critical of it. We've seen some of these foreign sponsors, like the Emirates or like the Saudis or others, in the war, you know, using their votes in order to favor their proxy or to criticize the other side. But I think, you know, the net effect of it will be that it's going to bring more attention and probably, I would say, you know, a more concerted level of international political attention on this conflict than we've seen in the past. Because part of the problem for those trying to bring peace to Sudan is that the conflict, even though it's been going on for the last 2.5 years, as you said in your introduction, you know, the scale and the level of human suffering has really been immense. In fact, it's the world's largest humanitarian crisis. But it has consistently been overshadowed by the conflicts in Gaza and in Ukraine, and it has really struggled to gain traction internationally or to get political momentum for a solution. So I think that the meeting at the UN will probably be one small step towards the Sudanese conflict rising a little bit higher on the international agenda, hopefully towards some sort of, you know, international coordination over the diplomacy, at least.
Declan, thanks for joining us on Late Night Live.
It was a pleasure.
I've been talking to Declan Walsh, Africa Bureau Chief of the New York Times, about the civil war in Sudan. And Declan has a podcast about Sudan's gold and its role in the war, coming out on the New York Times podcast. This is Late Night Live. Coming up, where has all the footage gone of November the 11th, 1975? Television crews in Canberra weren't expecting a busy day on the 11th of November 1975. They'd be at the War Memorial, of course, for the usual Remembrance Day ceremonies, wreath laying, that sort of thing. But apart from that, there was little on the slate. Then at lunchtime, journalists at Parliament House realised something big was on. Whitlam had been sacked. Something they knew well before word reached the Labor cabinet. Later in the afternoon, as the Governor-General's secretary stood on the steps to dissolve Parliament, television crews from 9, 7 and the ABC, indeed two ABC crews, were ready to film a big moment in the history of the nation. And almost none of that footage survives.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
That clip was shot by Channel 7's cameraman Bob Wildsmith. And one of the reasons you'll hear and see that over and over and over again on the 50th anniversary of November the 11th is that it's almost the only footage we have that survives of the key events of that day. Among the mysteries of that still puzzling day is the mystery of the missing film. To discuss, we're joined by Simon Smith, curator of the National Film and Sound Archive in Melbourne. Simon, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, David. It's an exciting thing to talk about.
Simon, first, what do we have?
Well, yes, you mentioned in your intro that we don't have a lot of film, David, and this is true, and it does take us back to the technology of the era. In this current day and age, we have, you know, digital cameras which can record mountains and mountains of vision. And even if we go back to the videotape era, you had at least an hour of videotape technology that was available to camera crews. But we're talking 1975 here. This is the era of the 16mm film camera. There were no portable video cameras being used by news crews at that time. So you're talking about a medium that is expensive, small, and of course it's a two-stage process. You need to be able to process it to see it. So film being used by camera crews was, I think it's fair to say, in relatively short supply. You didn't have mountains of film to play with. So whatever the news crews were filming in those days needed to be, you know, well composed, well framed, and there wasn't a huge amount of excess, which is why we don't have enormous amounts of footage. Even at the very next day, there probably wasn't hours of footage to choose from. But yes, some of that material survives, but most of it doesn't.
Okay, so what does survive? We have, of course, Whitlam on the steps running his line about God save the Queen with very shaky audio.
Yes, that's right. And that particular footage is the most well-known footage that is used in documentaries and specials all around the country and, I guess, beyond Australia. You're quite right. It does have this sort of distorted audio flutter to it. And what that means is we can actually identify exactly which camera and which broadcaster was filming that, and that this, for this occasion, was Channel 7. So the cameraman's name is Bob Wildsmith, and his camera had a problem with the sound recording head. It was a bit worn. So when the magnetic stripe on the film was recording Gough's audio, you've got that very distinctive sort of halting flutter of audio, which when you hear this, you know, instantly it's the Channel 7 footage.
We don't begrudge him that. but what Whitlam was talking about was the last words of the Governor-General's statement dissolving Parliament. Do we have the Secretary dissolving Parliament on film? I mean, that, after all, is the crucial act.
Certainly, there is film of David Smith coming out and reading on behalf of the Governor-General, Sir John Kerr, effectively dissolving Parliament. And Gough, of course, is standing over his shoulder listening to him say that. And the reason why Gough says that famous first line, which is, "Well, may we say, God save the Queen," because David Smith, as the Secretary, finishes the proclamation by saying, "God save the Queen."
Yep.
Then Gough steps in and says, "Well, may we say, God save the Queen, because nothing will save the Governor General." And then, of course, he talks about the famous line where he refers to Malcolm Fraser as Kerr's Kerr.
Oh, that's right. Yes, that ends with Kerr's Kerr. There's also footage, is there not, of Gough using a megaphone to get his message across at some point?
Yes, there's very brief footage of Gough using the megaphone, which appears to be from Channel 10's cameras, or Channel O. It might have been Channel O Melbourne. In those days, it was the O10 network, the 10 network as we know it today.
Of course, I left them off the list, yes.
they didn't. The 10 network didn't officially form as it is today until 1980, but back in 75, it was the O10 network. And yes, you're quite right, there is brief footage of Whitlam on a megaphone. In fact, you can see some other footage of Keating, Paul Keating, with Gough Whitlam, and Keating's holding the megaphone. But looking at the hour-by-hour events of that particular day, David, which I'm rereading from the Age newspaper and what they had on the day, it looks like Whitlam came out about four times between 4:40 in the afternoon and about 6:45. I think the megaphone footage is at one of his later appearances, and of course the news bulletins would have been going to air by 6 o'clock or 6:30. So
yes,
anything that he was doing after six wouldn't have been seen on that night because, as I say, there wasn't video to do direct outside broadcast.
Yeah, it took time. It took time to get these things. So, Simon, these are scraps. These are very important scraps, and they're the work of Channel 7. That's what we have. Why don't we have the footage from the ABC? There were two film crews operating in Canberra that day. Why don't we have that? Well, not a scrap of it, as I understand.
Well, there is a tiny scrap, and but you're quite right about the two crews. So for many people, they will know that the satirical character Norman Gunston was on the steps of Parliament that day and filmed a very famous moment where Gough comes out on one of those four occasions when he did come out onto the steps, and Gunston's there and everyone's incredulous. In fact, David, in the Age's odd spot the next day, Gunston's appearance made the odd spot. So it was certainly, he was certainly quite visible on the day. But yes, what you're alluding to is that on the very next day, so the 12th of November, the head of ABC Archives, or Wendy Borchers, she wrote a book in 2006 detailing how the film footage of the 75 dismissal day doesn't exist in ABC Archives. It was filmed. She, the next morning, contacted her Canberra-based colleague, the film editor up there, his name was Frank Reed, and said, "Can you please make sure that you send all the film, everything that you've got, straight down to us here in Sydney, and I'll make sure that it all gets copied and preserved. This is, you know, some of the most important political footage in Australia's history." He rang back 10 minutes later. He said, "You won't believe this. It's all gone. There is no footage here at all, including the offcuts. It's all gone." Now, that was recounted to her in 1975. She wrote the book in 2006. Nearly 20 years later, that film has not resurfaced. Those films has not resurfaced.
But Simon, how could it have gone?
A very interesting question. It could be government interference. It could have been straight theft. Who knows? It could have been one of Gough's supporters taking it.
No,
it
why would any of those people have wanted to destroy this footage?
Well, whether they wanted to destroy the footage or whether they wanted to keep it as a memento, who knows? Who knows? But I can say, David, that one thing that does survive in the ABC archives, they do have a short reel that is includes film from the day. There is actually a slightly different camera angle of that famous, well, may we say, comment. And honestly, you can't make this up, David. the length of the clip, which survives in ABC archives, runs for a duration of 11 minutes and 11 seconds. This is on the 11th of November, 1975. You cannot make this up. However, I think there is a clue in there as to where this footage may have come from. There's a very brief moment where you see Norman Gunston, Gary McDonald's character, Norman Gunston, interviewing the then Attorney General, I think it's Kip Enderby.
Yep.
And it's the one little bit of unused Gunston footage that didn't make it to the Norman Gunston Show episode. So I think that the 11 minutes that does survive may have come from the rival Gunston crew.
But that's all. I mean, film was bulky. Storing film took a lot of space. Archives of television stations frequently weeded out the material they had in order to, you know, for the space alone. I had heard rumours that that is what happened to the ABC footage, but that is not Wendy Borchers's account. It just mysteriously, overnight, disappeared. Now, if that is strange enough, what happened to Channel 9's footage?
Well, this is another interesting story. So there was a Channel 9 crew on the ground on the day, but they weren't there specifically to film the events of that particular afternoon. They were up there to film segments for a documentary that I think Channel 9 Melbourne was producing on the recently sacked treasurer, Jim Cairns. There's an oral history in the NFSA's collection where the cameraman, Ron Ashmore, details how he said they saw, you know, the comings and goings of people going in and out of Parliament House and not filming it because they didn't know. And then, of course, later on when there was up to, well, reports say anywhere between 3,000 and 5,000 people were on the steps of Parliament that day. Obviously, they started filming footage. Now, we very recently, David, we've uncovered about 30 seconds of the original TCN 9 Sydney broadcast of that night. And it features slightly different, again, footage, more in close-up of Gough. There's only about 10 seconds, I think, of him speaking. And then it goes to the start of the bulletin and Brian Henderson, of course, the long-time TCN 9 newsreader, commences the bulletin and then it stops. I'd say that that tape was acquired from Nine Archives maybe back in the 70s, and it was being used by a documentary crew for a documentary, a low-budget documentary. It was being made on the dismissal of Whitlam.
But what happened to Nine's original footage?
I believe that the cameraman involved may have retained it, and I believe, but without foundation, but we're investigating, that film may be in a large collection down here in Melbourne that still needs to be sorted out, and it's a collection that we may be able to commence going through. We don't have it currently, but it's a very large collection, and we may be able to start going through it in the next couple of months. But I think that it wasn't ever offered to Nine Archives. I suspect it was removed at the time and it was retained by the camera crew. But that's just a theory that
right.
I'm not 100% sure about.
There is also, of course, footage of the war memorial ceremonies. Again, Kerr in his spectacular swallow suit, you know, the swallow-cut coat and all of that business. I think the black top hat. Is there not a bit of footage, perhaps Channel 7 footage, of the hurried carrying from Whitlam's office of his filing cabinets?
Yes, absolutely. This is, I think, one of the most revealing bits of film, David, because Bob Wilesmith, the Seven cameraman, decided to go around the side of Parliament House, I think on the side of the House of Representatives. And there he captured these very big guys struggling with two very heavy four-door grey filing cabinets. They get very hastily put into the back of an unmarked white panel van, might have been two panel vans even, and then they quickly ferry off. I mean, David, this is a question back to you. What do you think was in those filing cabinets?
Well, you've got a right to take your filing cabinets. I mean, that's one of the things that any politician does. I mean, there was the wonderful, heartbreaking footage of John Howard's filing cabinets being carried out when finally he bit the electoral dust. But from that day, there's nothing of Fraser and there's nothing of Kerr, the other two principal players.
Yes, well, Fraser never came out onto the steps. He left at 3:45 to go off to Government House. Now, there is a little bit of film of him leaving and some of the demonstrators letting him know what they think of him. A can of beer is poured near the car as he gets in it, and he sort of winds down the window, smiles away, and then he gets driven off. So that's at 3:45, and then Whitlam first emerges at 4:40, about an hour later, and then you've got that the famous sequence with David Smith, the secretary, reading the proclamation, and then Whitlam, probably, I'm going to say it, about 4:47, saying the "Well, may we say" infamous moment. Yes.
Simon, so we've mentioned little bits and pieces, little scraps, the terrific Channel 7 footage, one or two brief sequences. But really, when you look at the day, it is oddly unrecorded.
Yes, I would agree with that. I would say that the Channel 7 footage amounts to about 6 minutes. The footage that we hold presently of Channel 9's original broadcast is about 30 seconds. I should say that Channel 7 were tremendously altruistic, David. They were aware of ABC being cleaned out. So the reason why the ABC will often show the Channel 7 footage with the audio issues is that 7 made copies because they thought it was just too important. So they gave the film a copy of the film. We have the original news film of that in the National Film and Sound Archives collection. But 7 gave a copy to ABC Archives and they said, you can use this. You have full copyright permission and in perpetuity. And I believe that 7 also did that to Channel 9. Not sure about Channel 10, but it was a very altruistic and, very generous move by 7 to do that. And that's why the same footage is seen across all the networks as a general rule.
Simon, thanks very much for joining us on Late Night Live.
Thank you so much, David.
I've been talking to Simon Smith, a curator at the National Film and Sound Archive in its Melbourne office, about the strange desert of film coverage of November the 11th, 1975. And because it's on our minds so much, let's hear Gough one more time.
Well, may we say, God save the Queen. Because nothing will save the Governor-General.
On our next, Ian Dunt with the latest from the UK, which I am sure is going to include champagne corks popping across London to celebrate the great work of the Crown 50 years ago in remote Canberra. Plus, we're going to Brazil, which is the site of the UN Climate Summit, but also a country of such entrenched police brutality that in Rio, cops are paid a bonus if they kill anyone they even suspect of being a gang member. And on a much more cheerful note, 70 years down the track, we celebrate CYRAC, one of the world's oldest surviving computers, safe and sound, in Melbourne University. Thank you.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.